Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and the internet is a wonderful thing, especially when it saves you maybe like $700.
I've got maybe like $700 off.
Exactly. That's Linda Perla with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. Linda says a new website made it easy to save cash on an expensive item.
I've got maybe like $700 off.
So here's a quiz. On what item did Linda get that discount? Was it A, a computer? Shop around and you'll find internet deals on spiffy new laptops. Or was it B, a used car? eBay's good for more than collecting Pez dispensers, you know. Or did Linda get a great deal on C, a nose job? A new website let her compare costs of surgical procedures and save. Give up? Stay close. The answer's coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money.
You search for the best deal on airfares. You search for the best deal on a plasma TV. And these days, you can search for the best deal on a colonoscopy. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at thriveq.com.
If you've ever tried to read a hospital bill, you probably ended up back in the ER with an ulcer. $50 for a Band-Aid, $20,000 for an IV. Well, this week, the insurance company Anthem Blue Cross announced it's expanding a pilot program that allows patients to shop for the best deal on, say, a gallbladder removal. It's another development in what's been dubbed consumer-driven healthcare. Helen Palmer reports from the health desk at WGBH on whether it can really make a difference in our hospital bills.
You'd think Consumers Union, publisher of that Bible of Best Values, Consumer Reports, would cheer the availability of health price data. But Consumers Union's Bill Vaughan says most of the information out there is confusing. Vaughan says you should first turn to your state for answers.
There's 30 states that have passed one kind of law or another requiring disclosure of pricing information.
California and Florida do a particularly good job because they give comparisons on both cost and quality. They post hospital death rates, for example. Wisconsin pioneered PricePoint, a program so clear and easy to use that 9 other states have adopted it. Insurance companies are also posting prices. First out of the gate was Aetna. Chief Medical Officer Troy Brennan.
Well, the prices are the prices that we directly negotiate with individual providers. So things like how much an office visit costs and simple procedures that are done within the office, such as tests for blood and stool, rapid strep tests.
The medical director for Anthem Blue Cross says its website's unique because it can tell you the total cost for a more complicated procedure, like a colonoscopy. It does this by lumping together the doctor's cost, facility cost, anesthesiologist, even the medicines you'll take. So members can really compare prices, says Anthem's Barry Malinowski.
You have to put in your member ID number.
And it goes from minimum agreed price of $699 to a maximum agreed price of $977 at the low end.
Right.
And if you go down to the high end, we have a minimum agreed price of $2,796 compared with a maximum of $3,075.
You can figure that probably the cost of your procedure to you from a copay standpoint is going to be 20% of $699 or 20% of $977.
Or, of course, 20% of $2,700 if you choose a more expensive facility. Malinowski says Anthem first tested the system in Dayton, Ohio, with General Motors. GM's Sam Shalaby thinks it's great for employees.
Better care at lower cost. Ultimately, they would get healthier, and that will have an impact on their quality of life and on their productivity.
It's not just states and insurance companies that are trying to be transparent. Hospitals are getting in on the act. Hospital company HCA offers what it calls true out-of-pocket costs for both insured and uninsured patients. There are also websites like HealthGrades and the newly launched Revolution Health that let consumers research cost and quality. HealthGrades charges a small fee. Linda Perler, an executive assistant in Manhattan, paid $8 to check out credentials of plastic surgeons and get a good price for a nose job.
I'll say I got maybe like $700 off.
Perler says she felt confident. She'd done her research and was able to use that research to bargain. And ultimately, that's the whole point behind posting healthcare prices, that as empowered consumers, we will take control. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com.
For the next few weeks, we'll be hanging out with three investment clubs. We're following their progress all this year. And after the first installment in the series, we got lots of questions from you. But what you really wanted to know was, how do I join or start a club? So we asked San Jose Club members Kathy Tegmeyer, Marvin Cohn, and Martha Alderson for some advice.
Everyone thinks they want to join an already seasoned veteran club and come in and absorb the knowledge. And where you really get the value, I think, is by starting with other people who know just as little as you do and coming up through the ranks together and educating as a group.
There are clubs that try to be virtual clubs where no money is actually changing hands, and I think that they often have trouble with people losing interest and not paying attention.
But it's how much money you can, afford, but also, you know, skin in the game.
But what about the basics, such as how do you decide what you're going to charge per month? How do you decide if there's a membership fee? Who takes what stock to follow?
Actually, all those questions are real interesting and real easy. First of all, I must suggest that you contact Better Investing. They have, among other things, a draft copy of a partnership agreement, because an investment club legally has to be an entity. And the best entity for it is a partnership because of the tax structure. Among other things, BI has a listing in their magazine which shows all of the local chapters. Contact a chapter representative. And the amount of money you want to put in, for example, depends upon the group.
All right, Kathy?
Yes. The typical club will collect dues monthly, and the dues will be somewhere between maybe $25 and $100. But you want enough money that you can actually invest in stocks and buy stocks, because as soon as you have money on the line, you'll pay more attention.
What about when you get to, say, it's time to sell a stock? Is there, I don't know, a computer program that will tell you how much that takes out from every individual in the club, or say when somebody leaves the club, how much they get of the pot?
This is Kathy. There are software programs that you can buy or gain access to with a fee, an annual fee, that do the calculations, the arithmetic for you.
Can you recommend a program?
I can recommend two different companies that provide them. One is called Bivio. The other company has two different programs that you can buy, and the company's name is iClub. And I can highly recommend either one of those companies as providing really good, reliable software.
The other thing that, when I was listing things a club needs to do is it forms. Once you've actually decided, yes, you want to become an investment club, one of the very first things you should have someone do is contact the IRS and fill out an SS-4 form. And that's a tax ID form.
But you can be a beginner. You can start out knowing nothing about the stock market.
All of us started out knowing nothing as rank beginner, newbie, didn't know diddly stock investors.
By the way, I started out back in 1968 knowing nothing.
And now they know a lot. And you can find a link to Better Investing on our website. Later in the show, we'll catch up with the San Jose Club and see how their investments fared since January. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. So now you know how to start an investment club. But let's say you're looking for something a little less formal, without the legal contracts and dues, somewhere you can just toss around ideas about stocks, chat with other investors. Marketplace's Elisa Roth looks at a new portfolio of social networking sites.
Mark Coker is a Silicon Valley entrepreneur and a regular on Yahoo Finance's stock message boards. Coker uses the web the way fans of obscure science fiction novels or collectors of Santa Claus figurines might.
The people who share my interest in stocks only represent a small slice of society. The internet allows me to remove geographic barriers.
But investing has real consequences that Santa Claus collections probably don't have. So for investing websites to be useful, they have to be more than just places for investors to spout opinions. As with any review, whether a newspaper's movie critic or a friend's suggestion of a restaurant, it helps to know the person's taste, or in this case, their investment style and track record.
The key is to form your opinions not on the basis of a single post or a single comment, but on the sum total of that person's posts over history. The longer you participate in these boards, the better sense you'll get for which posters are credible, which posters are providing good information, and which posters are full of it.
I might ultimately hate the roast chicken that restaurant reviewer swooned over, or I might love the movie everyone else hated. But with stock picks, there's empirical proof about whether someone made the right choice or not. That's precisely what Weiting Liu is counting on with his site, socialpicks.com. It allows users to follow their own stock picks and look at the track records of other users and non-users like Warren Buffett.
We want to give people who deserve credibility for them to believe, even though they are not professional money managers, or even though they are professional managers but didn't have the chance to appear on TV like some other people do.
This is now Mad Money with Jim Cramer, Esquire. Other people want to make friends. I have an enemies list as long as my bad arm.
Liu points out that even experts, like CNBC commentator Jim Cramer, get it right only about half the time.
Statistically and theoretically, a person out of nowhere can really know what he's talking about and can be an expert on a specific domain. But because he's not a TV celebrity, he couldn't have his voices heard.
And there are plenty of other investing sites. Yahoo Finance boards are company-specific. Others, such as Bullpoo.com and The Motley Fool, let you track a fantasy portfolio. Not everyone is taken with the idea. Maria Crawford Scott is with the American Association of Individual Investors. She thinks serious investors would be better off spending their time using more tried-and-true research methods.
You have limited resources as an individual investor. You've got limited time, and you ought to spend it looking for things that really match your own needs.
She worries that even well-established sites don't have enough history to be useful tools for investors. And she says it's impossible to know if a poster is pushing a particular stock for a reason. To short it, say. Social Picks Woo says that doesn't matter, since he imagines tracking his site's users over very long stretches, like several years. He's so sure about what the data will prove, he says, he pictures the day when promising young MBA students list their Social Picks track record on their resumes. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace Money.
What makes a financial advisor worth the money? Chris puts a price on good advice in the mailbag. And making a living in a tutu isn't all frou-frou.
You really never know with this job. You can be here 1 minute and gone the next.
A day in the work life of a ballerina. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Veglund. This week, the New York City Ballet gave Shakespeare a lift. Literally. It launched a high-flying world premiere of everyone's favorite tale of doomed teens in love. I'm sure you remember it. Justin and Brittany. No. I mean Romeo and Juliet. 19-year-old Robin Fairchild plays Romeo, and Juliet, well, we'll let her speak for herself. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we sit in on rehearsals with a ballerina.
So guys, try not to bring this leg down. Try to, when you bop on your knee, bring it to the left, not down. Ready?
My name is Sterling Hilteen. I'm 21 years old, and I've been dancing with the New York City Ballet almost 5 years now.
And one. That's it. And
am a rarer case. I didn't know I wanted to be in New York City Ballet or even dance professionally until I had already moved up to New York. I just thought I would take ballet classes to get into a decent college, but I always gave my 100% and then just sort of took the next step. It's like everything just presented itself to me and I just kept going to the next place, and everything has worked out so seamlessly, but I'm so happy, even though it wasn't necessarily a childhood dream. You know, when you're a student, you rehearse for one show, maybe or two shows out of the whole year, and you'll rehearse maybe 4 months for it. Once you reach New York City Ballet, you're lucky if you get four rehearsals for it. New York City Ballet puts ballets together quicker than probably any company in the world, I would say. And I think that was probably the biggest challenge, is learning choreography so quickly. And it's really interesting because I can tell my mind has gotten much faster since I first joined the company. My day is very physical. There's always a warm-up class to get ready for your day. I work on what I need to work on, but I don't push myself in that class because I often have a lot of rehearsals for the rest of the day, and I have to pace myself. Then I typically, right now for Romeo and Juliet, we rehearse it 3 hours a day. After the high of a show, a lot of times I can't go to bed until at least 12:30. The typical salary of a dancer in New York City ranges anywhere from maybe $65,000 or $68,000 to $100,000, depending on your rank. First, you're an apprentice, which is a trial period. And then when you first officially join the company, your title is corps de ballet. The rank following that is soloist, and then the highest rank, principal. I'm a soloist. When somebody gets injured, that's something that happens very often. It is a fear that everybody has, and you really never know with this job. You can be here 1 minute and gone the next. There's always multiple people learning a role. So if somebody gets hurt, you know, the next person's sort of up to bat. My advice for anybody who wants to be a professional dancer, always give your 100%, especially when you're the most tired, because that's when you better yourself one degree more. Very often you have to go on stage or you have to dance when you don't feel that great, and you can't let the audience know that, and you have to condition yourself to do that. The show must go on.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Bess Cargman.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com. And by the NASD Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at NASDFoundation.org.
Three-day trip, man. Brings us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, Woodstock of Capitalism. The Woodstock of Capitalism is an annual three-day meeting hosted by billionaire Warren Buffett. It's held far from Woodstock in Buffett's home of Omaha, Nebraska. And instead of nude hippies, there's thousands of squares in business suits. Shareholders in Buffett's company, Berkshire Hathaway. They come to groove on Buffett's totally heavy economic wisdom. Want to get on the list for the fest this week? Just buy Berkshire stock. One share will set you back around $108,000. Like, wow.
Got a box full of letters. Thinking my life.
I'm Tess Viglund, and it's my favorite part of the show, the time when we get to hear from you. But before we start, allow me to introduce all of you to Mr. Chris Farrell, our resident economics expert. He's here to help us answer all of your questions. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Tess. How are you doing?
I'm well and good and ready to lob questions in your direction.
And I'm ready to take them.
Excellent. But before we start, please do take down our website address. It's marketplace.org. Click on the contact button, or you can give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. And we go first to the phones, and we've got John on the line from Minnesota. Hey, John.
Hey, how are you?
We're doing well, and you?
Doing all right, thanks.
All right. Well, tell us what your question is for Chris today.
Yeah, I'll try and keep it as simple as I can.
Sounds like it might be complicated.
Yeah. You know, I've put some money into a retirement account, and so has my partner. He's Chinese and has an H-1B visa here. And he now has kind of like the green card equivalent in Canada.
In Canada?
Yeah. So we're given real consideration to moving there in the next half year or so.
Hmm.
And we're wondering, once we're there, well, what do we do with our retirement accounts?
Interesting. Chris, I would assume that there are some tax implications, maybe all kinds of potential complications here. So what's your advice for them?
Okay. There is actually a vast literature about dealing with retirement plans between the U.S. and Canada. And the new government, on their list of things that they would like to accomplish, is that they've reached an agreement in principle to, in the tax treaty, to sort of deal with retirement plans between Canada and the U.S. more equitably and make the rules a little bit cleaner. But I don't believe it's been done yet. So here's my advice. Do nothing. Just leave them alone. The money will compound. You move to Canada. You look at the landscape. You see how it's going to work out for you. And then there is a whole industry of essentially lawyers who do deal with this between Canadians who have decided to move to the U.S., and dealing with bringing their tax savings from Canada to the U.S., or Americans who have moved to Canada. Hopefully, the rules will be simplified because there's a lot of Canadians working here, a lot of Americans working in Canada, going back and forth, and there's really no reason for it to be as complicated as it is right now.
Okay. So, John, really the advice is go ahead, get on with your life, do whatever you need to do, and then worry about the implications on down the line when you start to take money out of those accounts. And get some good advice from a lawyer.
Okay. And that would be true both for my partner with an H-1B as well as for me as a U.S. citizen?
Yes. The only issue that will start complicating things is if you are continuing to contribute to the plans, and then, you know, then that comes into the tax treaty and it's considered part of your income while you're in Canada, et cetera, et cetera. But that's the type of thing that a tax accountant will be able to deal with fairly easily and routinely. But if you're just not adding to them, you're just allowing them to compound while you explore what you're going to be doing in Canada, then there is really no issue whatsoever.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thanks for the call.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. And how about a reach into the email bag, Chris? Does that sound good?
That sounds really good.
All right. Let me reach into the bottom here. Let me pull one out. Here we go. All right. Mary writes in from Redlands, California. Mary's daughter owes about $100,000 in student loans. Ouch. So they want to try to negotiate a buyout of this student loan. And it seems like the loan holder would want to negotiate a settlement since currently the daughter is in default and isn't likely to ever be able to pay back this amount. So what is the likelihood that they will be able to get out of this situation paying less than what is owed?
You know, the student loan situation is really tough. Now, we talk a lot about the benefits of it, you know, in terms of paying for your education. But once you're in default, a lot of really bad things can happen to you. You get referred to a collection agency. They can garnish your wages. If you get a tax refund,
they can take it.
They can take it. So if she is in default, she'll want to rehabilitate herself. And so rehabilitation, you call whoever owns the paper, the lender, you ask them about their program, you make a certain number of payments, and it's usually a negotiated price or mm-hmm. deal that you do.
But it is negotiable, you're saying?
It is negotiable. So okay. What I would do is go back and negotiate, but understand, let's just say you know, $100,000. They're not going to say you're not going to owe us any money.
They're not going to wipe the slate clean.
There is no easy way out of this, but default is not the right route to go. You want to talk to your lender again and again, ad nauseum. I think that's what she needs.
All right, Mary, a tough situation, but hopefully that advice can help you get started on the way toward correcting it. And if you're looking for a solution to a unique financial problem, or if you have a solution and you just want to make sure it's a good idea, click on the contact button on our website. It's marketplace.org, or call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. All right, let's head to the phones again. We've got Steve on the line from Danville, Pennsylvania. How are you doing, Steve?
Good, good. How are you, Tess?
We're doing all right. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm in the market for a first-time home, and I am seeking some advice as to how best to go about financing this major purchase.
Excellent question. A lot of people looking at how to buy their first homes. Tell us a little bit about your financial situation. What do you do? What kind of money do you make?
Well, I work as a rehab technician in a major medical center in the little town of Danville in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. I gross about $28,000 a year, so I'm a low-wage income earner. Debt-free, my credit rating's over 800.
Wow. What kind of savings do you have?
Well, I have a couple IRAs, personal savings accounts, some money markets, and, you know, over $100,000 in retirement accounts.
Okay.
And I'm looking to put 20% down, and I've met with some mortgage lenders locally, and I've been pre-qualified. But there's just so many options out there, and I've done some homework, but it's almost too much information.
All right. Well, Chris, what do you think? Given the financial situation, what's his best bet for getting this first home?
Well, I have a couple thoughts. Now, typically, and if you've been listening, Steve, you know my financial advice always leans toward the conservative side, and I love 20% down. I mean, just love 20% down. However, you're obviously really good with money. And, you know, you've really amassed quite a bit of savings on not a very high income. So, you know, my advice loosens up for somebody like you. So I have a couple of thoughts. One is I would check with state programs where you can put a lot less down and still get a very favorable mortgage. And that can be one of the easiest ways to qualify as a first-time home buyer. So at least I would check that out.
And I have.
And do you qualify?
Yes, I do. I'm looking at a 30-year fixed rate at 5.95, and that's without any points.
That's wonderful. Now, is that with 20% down?
With 20% down, yes.
Now, the question that I would raise is: Do you think you're going to have to withdraw money from your retirement accounts for the down payment to meet that 20%, or can you do it without doing that?
I have a Roth IRA. It's the newest of my IRAs. And according to regulations, if I take it from the Roth, there's no penalty and no taxes paid on it. So by default, I'm going to have to choose the Roth IRA and unfortunately deplete that entire account.
And with the Roth, you can only pull out what you've actually put in, right, Chris? Not the earnings on your money?
You would still pay taxes on the earnings. The advantage of the Roth, and by the way, this is one of the reasons why I'm such a big fan of the Roth, and if you don't mind, my Steve, I'll use you as an example. And we'll just make up an example and say, hey, you've been putting $2,000 a year for the past 5 years into your Roth, so you have $10,000. It's a great way to save because it's part of your retirement portfolio, but you can withdraw that $10,000 with no penalty.
But anything you've earned on it has to stay there.
Exactly. Here's what I would do. Run some numbers, putting 10% down. See how that changes your financial position and how much less would you have to take out of the Roth.
Well, Chris, let me ask two questions. One is, you know, we hear all the time that we should never touch our retirement funds, that retirement money is for retirement and it should stay there. And second, if he does do a 10% down, then he's looking at what we call a piggyback loan, right?
No, not necessarily. You could just you put 10% down and then all you're really doing is borrowing 90%. You're going to pay private mortgage insurance. And private mortgage insurance, I don't get that upset about, frankly.
Really?
I mean, I know people hate it and they get all worked up about it and how terrible it is. But, you know, you do private mortgage insurance, it's not the end of the world. And the fact of the matter is that the equity increases, get the 20%, you cancel the private mortgage insurance, and you're not doing a piggyback loan. The goal is not to tap your retirement money.
Right. In a perfect world.
If you do take some retirement money out, you're going to take that little incremental bit out of your Roth IRA and leave the rest of your retirement money alone.
Right. Well, I don't go into tapping my retirement funds happily. Doing the math, it's the only way I'm going to be able to meet that 20% down.
And just make sure to try to pay yourself back at some point.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Does that help you out, Steve?
Very much so.
Terrific. Well, we'll check in with you later on and see what you ended up doing, all right?
Okay.
Thanks for the call. Well, you never know what can happen when you follow some good common sense when it comes to money. If you need any suggestions how to get your financial plan started, do give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Or just visit our website. We're at marketplace.org. Click on the contact button. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, and one final reach into the email bag, Chris. We've got Dahlia writing in from Rolla, Missouri. And she has a financial planner overseeing both her and her mother's finances. Some years he does very well for them. Sometimes the things that he urges them to participate in, different financial vehicles, just don't do well at all. So her question is there any way to compare his performance to other money managers? And how do you really know that your advisor is doing the very best job they can for you?
There's a couple of things. Let's just assume for the moment that this advisor is giving good service. Then you want to, just as she's asking, how do you compare his performance? How is he doing? And the way that I would like to do it that I think is realistic is you sort of go, all right, he's been putting me into, you know, big company stocks, you know, brand name stocks, IBM, Microsoft, companies like that. So I'm going to look at the S&P 500 and I'm going to see how the S&P 500 did. And then I'm going to look at and what the return is, and then I'm going to look at how he did in comparison to the S&P 500. And in fact, I'm going to be realistic about it because I'm going to go to assume that I pay a fee for my S&P 500, which you will, and what did I pay over the year for what he's done. That's one way to compare it. Now let's say that he's been giving small company, Chris Farrell Inc., Tess Inc. We don't have a whole lot of money and we're sort of small. So you might look at the Russell 2000 because that captures the universe of small company stocks. So this is one way to compare the performance.
Just basically go in and look at indexes.
Make it real simple, make it real quick, and then basically ask yourself, okay, how much am I paying this person? And, am I satisfied with the service? And take a look at the returns.
Any other ways?
That's the way that I would do it. Of course, there's a slight bias to this advice, which you have probably picked up on. At the end of the day, I think that you should have the core of your money indexed.
In index funds.
Right. Now, you may still want to have this advisor. A lot of times we want to be dealing with a professional. But nevertheless, you want to act like the IBM pension fund or any really good pension fund. What makes up the bulk of those pension assets are tied to an index fund or index funds. And then you have some alternative investments, and this advisor might be an alternative investment.
All right. Well, unfortunately, that is all the questions we can take on this week's show. But please do leave your question for a future program on our voicemail. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, M-O-N-Y. Or just hop on over to the contact page on our website. It's marketplace.org. Thanks so much, Chris, as always.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
Just because you bought the house of your dreams doesn't mean you can afford it. Tales from the housing bubble pop next. And our San Jose Investment Club divines the future of the Dow.
For me, whenever it's breaking new highs, it almost presents kind of a cautionary note. So I'm kind of expecting a pullback.
You are listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Back now to our series about investment clubs. We're following three of them in Seattle, San Jose, and Fairfax, Virginia, as they figure out what stocks to buy, sell, and hold throughout the year.
The stock didn't do very well.
What sectors do you buy? Prices are going to continue to go up.
Join the club.
It's been a little more than 3 months since our last trip to San Jose, California. This club meets once a month at an Italian joint called Frankie, Johnny, and Luigi's, which means it's time to make us hungry again.
Bistro steak salad? Yes.
Okay. I'll take the chicken salad.
I'd like the bistro steak salad with the vinaigrette.
I'll have the chicken and sausage cannelloni.
The late April meeting found just four club members in attendance, in the order that they ordered: Martha Alderson, Alan Smith, Kathy Tegmeyer, and Marvin Cohn. And while they waited for lunch to arrive, Marvin brought up a less than appetizing potential investment.
Did you see this interesting article on waste management? Mm-hmm. I went to Valueline and looked at the environmental industry. But strangely enough, waste management, as they describe it, comes out to be a buy. So this is something we could mull over. They are making hay on the fact that they own a lot of the dumps.
They decided to do a little more research before making any decisions on investing in the company. So I asked them how the club's done since our last visit.
I'm happy.
Me too.
Same here. I did a little evaluation on my own personal portfolio. I'm currently at an all-time high. So,
congratulations.
Me too.
Made an all-time high today.
Well,
the Dow is up over 13,000 now. It's 13,808.
What does that mean to you?
I think we use it as a general indicator. It's not that we own the Dow, but we do own a goodly number of large companies. For me, whenever it's breaking new highs, it almost actually, for me, presents kind of a cautionary note. So I'm kind of expecting there to be a pullback, perhaps, if not now, sometime in the next 2 or 3 months. We've had a really, really strong run for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's getting a little long in the legs.
Did any of you as a club do anything in reaction to the biggest point drop we've seen recently, which was after the crash in Shanghai and Alan Greenspan over in Asia talking about a possible recession? Did that affect your...
Yeah, we had a nice meal here. And pontificated and chewed the cud a little bit.
This is Martha. My recollection was that the China blip happened pretty close to a meeting. And I think one of the things we talked about was because the U.S. markets dropped a little bit too, we started looking at our do we want to buy more of anything else list.
Is there anything that you can pinpoint in terms of the 3 months since the last time I talked to you that has affected your buying and selling? Anything macro, or has it really been based upon the individual stocks that the club holds?
It's pretty much that.
One of the things that I've been realizing this last few months as the market's gone up, I'm able to identify good growth companies, but the prices are going a little higher now, so I'm not as easily buying stocks.
That's been one of our problems, actually. Well, we've ended up with more cash than we would like quite often. It's actually finding companies that we identify as being worth buying have been very difficult.
This is Martha. We feel like the price is a little high. They're just a little too expensive. We don't want to pay that just yet.
In January, the club's net worth was just over $21,000. By the meeting in April, they had $29,782, all but $4,000 of that invested in the market. So they had some money to play with while they reviewed their current holdings. If memory serves, you had O'Reilly Automotive back in January.
We still do.
Mm-hmm. Still do.
Yeah, we've held.
Have you held on to that for quite a while?
One of our first ones. The December quarter, their profits, earnings per share growth, was 0%. But then the most recent quarter that ended in March, 20%. So they're back on track. I think that's one of our oldest stocks now, possibly.
We bought O'Reilly back on October 24th of 2002. We have almost tripled our investment. We bought it for roughly $13.70 and is now, as of Friday, $34.80.
Well, that's typical for us. So you find a good company and you just let it grow.
Have you bought any new companies this year?
Yes.
Yeah. Tier 1, it's a bank.
It's a bank.
Have you sold anything this year?
Yes, we just sold Corporate Executive Board. Yeah, their guidance for the coming year was lower than what we wanted in the way of growth rates. Yeah.
Sounds like at this point, at the end of April, you are fairly happy with your holdings. You're not going to buy or sell after this meeting.
Flag was raised.
So Kathy has a problem with Chico's, CHS. It's struggling trying to do good growth.
You've had a nice run on Chico's.
Compound annual return was 27.
Oh, there you
and
go
so that. that's a little high because we bought them less than a year ago.
Yeah.
So it was about 9 months ago.
Any coffee or dessert, anyone?
No.
Refills on your drinks?
No dessert, no refills, and no decision on Chico's, the women's clothing store. That, and whether to put some money into garbage, will be decided at the next meeting. And so we move on. Next week, a check-in with the Seattle Club at the pub.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
One of the country's biggest subprime lenders, New Century, declared bankruptcy last month. Then this week, the company announced 2,000 layoffs because it can't find a buyer. Comeuppance, perhaps, for its role in helping people buy homes they couldn't afford? This month's Money Magazine takes a look at how this whole mortgage mess happened and what we can learn from it. Reporter Stephen Gandell is with us. And Stephen, a lot of it has to do with the secondary market for mortgages. You want to explain?
It used to be you go to your local bank branch, there'd be a loan officer there, and he would sign you up with a mortgage that he wanted you to pay for the next 30 years because that's where the bank made its money off you paying back the interest. Now, most banks will sell you that mortgage, but then they'll sell it to someone else, like a big Wall Street firm. They'll package up that mortgage, your mortgage, with hundreds of other mortgages like that. And then they'll turn around to their investors and resell that mortgage.
What does this change mean in terms of what kinds of mortgages people can get and who is actually getting those mortgages, who they're actually lending to?
It means banks are willing to lend to pretty much anyone in any way they want it, whether it's responsible or not, because they don't hold the risk of the mortgage anymore. They sell that mortgage off into this vast and complex financing system. So no one really has any stake in making sure that the right mortgage is sold to the right person.
How is it that investors aren't as concerned about this as you would think they would be?
Well, I think investors are concerned about it now because they bought these bonds based on a certain amount of assumptions. They relied on investment banks. They relied on rating agencies to tell them how much risk they had. And I agree. I think people took on more risk than they thought they were. But here's how the logic of it all works. These bonds that are based on mortgages are structured in a way that they pay a low interest rate to the people who get paid back first, something a little bit better than a treasury bond, because they have the assurance that the first mortgage payments that come in pay off their bonds. The people at the very bottom get a much higher interest rate. Those people are willing to take on the higher risk because they are going to be paid a much higher interest rate. I'm not sure it's going to work out. I mean, the defaults that are happening in the mortgage market are much higher than people predicted. But the logic was that I can take on these risky mortgages. I can buy the bonds that are backed by subprime mortgages, are backed by mortgages that may even be greater than the value of the houses. I can buy those bonds because I'm getting paid a higher interest rate. And so I'm getting compensated for the risk I'm taking.
So everyone here is taking some sort of risk, maybe except the bank at this point. Which is just merely selling off the mortgage. But really, most of that lies on the shoulders of the borrower who may not even understand that they could be getting a mortgage that they really can't afford, but it doesn't really matter to anybody else.
That's correct. Over the last 10 years, the mortgage market has built up a financing system that does a very good job of spreading the risk among banks and mortgage brokers and investors. When you take out a mortgage with your bank, it's funneled into this system that many people will now hold a small portion of your mortgage. And they'll hold a small portion of hundreds of mortgages. So any individual mortgage, they won't really care much about whether that defaults. But to the borrower, whether they are able to pay their mortgage, whether they default on their mortgage, it means whether they have the ability, a place to live. But to the average investor, that risk has been spread out so effectively that any single mortgage can go bad and their mortgage, their portfolio isn't hurt. The problem here is that the system for financiers, for investors, works better than it's ever worked before.
Mm-hmm.
Even with all the defaults we're hearing about, there probably won't be a major financial catastrophe. There probably won't be an S&L crisis. There probably won't be any kind of major money center bank going bankrupt because the system is very good right now at spreading out the risk for the financial players. But for the actual homeowners, there's no way to spread the risk of you not being able to pay the mortgage. If you can't pay your mortgage, you lose your house. But for the financial players, your house is only a small fraction of the portfolio they own. And even if they bought the bond, there are complex financial instruments these days that allow them to lay the risk off of whether you pay it or not.
Well, what can consumers, homebuyers do to protect themselves at this point, given the system operates how it operates now?
You really need to try to understand the mortgage you're getting because there's so many different options out there, and a mortgage broker will sell you any mortgage, even if it's not right for you. So you need to try to understand what it is. Understand what the maximum rate you might have to pay. You should shop around. Most people believe that mortgage brokers have a duty to be on your side. In fact, they don't. Mortgage brokers work for the bank. You need to do your own shopping around. The third thing you should do is hire your own appraiser. You may be paying for the appraiser, but the appraiser works for the bank.
All right. Stephen Gandell is a senior writer with Money Magazine. Thanks for coming in and helping us sort this through.
Thanks for having me.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
White House officials say the president
and the experts
is
say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
looks like it's going to be the best
they
quarter.
They decide what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It's time once again for our economics editor Chris Farrell to help you sort out what's smart, what is stupid, and what is the straight story. And Chris, here's the issue of the week. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke keeps worrying about inflation. He's a worrier. And he even says that the Fed may have to raise rates. But I got to tell you, all these latest numbers that we're getting show that the economy is barely growing. How big a risk could inflation really be at this point?
Well, not much. I mean, that's what a couple of heavyweights on Wall Street are saying. These are chief economists at Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, UBS. They're not worried about inflation. In fact, they fear the opposite, slow growth or even a recession.
So why would the Fed be looking at raising rates? Why not actually cut them?
Well, that's what these Wall Streeters say. They say, hey, Ben, cut the rates. But I don't think Mr. Bernanke is going to do it. Here's the straight story. The Bernanke Fed is determined to show the world it is vigilant against inflation. It's not going to take the bars off the window just because there hasn't been a crime for a long time. And I don't think it has any choice.
What happens if the Fed continues to raise interest rates in a slow growth environment in this economy?
Well, the economy continues to slow. Now, here's the big divide is how do you think about the housing market? Something we talk about all the time.
Right.
The Wall Street economist and also one of my favorite economists, who's not really an economist, he's an investment manager, Bill Gross at PIMCO. Mm-hmm. You know, he also worries about declining prices in the housing market. All these foreclosures, it's going to take the economy down with it. The Fed is saying no. It's a confined problem. We're going to worry about inflation. And I think what they're doing, they're taking Pascal's wager, a famous wager made several centuries ago.
And what would that be?
Well, Pascal's wager was, he said, look, is there a God or isn't there a God? He goes through this whole thing and he decides, you know, if I behave as if there is a God and there is, I come out ahead. And if there isn't, I led a virtuous life. From the point of view of the Fed, if Wall Street, the global capital markets, ever think that we're weak on inflation, the consequences are serious. So I think the Fed is making a Pascal's wager that they're going to continue to stay tough against inflation. And by the way, if it turns out that inflation is non-existent, the economy weakens, they're going to change their mind.
Who, if anyone, gets hurt by the Fed staying tough on inflation as the economy goes sour?
Well, I want to go from Pascal to Karl Marx.
From God to Karl Marx. Okay.
That's right. Exactly. The ones who get hurt are the workers. And this comes from Peter Bernstein, who's the dean of finance economists, did a wonderful analysis. And look, we all know workers have not been getting wage increases. Best you can describe this economy is wage stagnation. So what happens in the scenario you described? The Fed stays tough against inflation, keeps its benchmark interest rate at 5.25%, maybe even raises it. Mm-hmm. The economy slows down. It's the worker that is going to suffer in this tight monetary policy regime. That's who I worry about. And by the way, if you look at low-income groups, they're living in a recession. That's what the implosion of the subprime mortgage market is telling you.
Just as an aside here, Greenspan, he was famous for never actually setting a target on inflation.
Yeah.
What has Bernanke said in terms of where the current Fed wants that rate to be?
Well, they've never actually come out and made the explicit target, which we all thought was going to happen when Bernanke became the Fed chairman,
right,
because he, as a
right.
scholar, wrote a lot about that. But the Fed is in a straitjacket. Drives me crazy. They say, we want an inflation rate between 1-2%. So right now, the inflation rate, depending on which one you're using, is running at 2.1% to 2.5%. That's too high. Give me a break.
So you think Bernanke's on the wrong track here, huh?
I've given you an analysis of what I think Bernanke is doing and why he's behaving the way he is. But for me, I think he's completely wrong. He should be cutting rates. This economy is slowing. And by the way, there's no inflation. You have high energy prices. You have high food prices. You do not have high and rising inflation.
All right, the straight story from our man, Chris Farrell. Chris, thanks for always rising to our inflated expectations of you.
Well, I tried to exceed them, Tess, and thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, your college class of 2007. No more books to buy, no more finals. Time to get out there in the world and manage your own finances.
Like, no way!
No worries. Help is, hopefully, on the way from your predecessors. We want to hear from college students who graduated last year. How did you handle balancing your checkbook, paying off your loans? What mistakes did you make? Visit our website, marketplace.org, and click on the link that says graduate. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, our Seattle Investment Club explores a new way to go global.
They will allow Americans to buy common stock in Canada, France, Germany, Hong Kong, Japan, and the United Kingdom.
Marketplace Money is produced by Wendy Sykes with Rico Galliano, Nancy Fargali, James Richter, Stephen Hoffman, Michelle Philippi, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tessa Biglund. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at thriveq.com.
American Public Media.